And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now is climate scientist at the University of California, Dr. Daniel Swain. Dr. Swain, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I know that you are going to be involved with Mountain Towns 2030 coming up here in just a couple days through a webinar on January 14th, where you're taking a look at early season snowpack across the western U.S. And talking about snowpack, there's a lot to unpack there. Being here in Park City, we are feeling that dramatically in the Mountain West and especially in a resort ski town. So I want to cover that. But first, before we get to all of that, I would love to hear more about you and your background and what led you to become a climate scientist.
Well, I am, as you mentioned, a climate scientist today, but that actually means different things for different climate scientists. My personal background actually comes from weather, from meteorology. So the short-term variations in the atmosphere, those day-to-day changes, the kinds of things we look to when we're planning a trip or planning a wardrobe for the week ahead, thinking about climate change increasingly through that weather lens, thinking about how the envelope of the day-to-day weather that we experience, and year-to-year, of course, is changing in a warming world. So I sort of come into this climate world from a very practical background of what is the weather like today, tomorrow, and are there any hazards associated with that or not? So when we talk about conditions like this year, for example, where we've seen some pretty extraordinary weather conditions across the Mountain West, that's exactly the kind of thing that is of great interest to me scientifically, and that also that I spend a lot of time talking about with broader audiences. I'm pretty active on social media and traditional media and just getting the word out and talking to people, meeting people where they are regarding all of these things.
Yeah, and when you say meeting people where they are, can you talk to me about the importance of climate communication and how you properly distill it down so that everyone can understand it?
Definitely. You know, one of the interesting and to me concerning things about where we are today, put the physical science aside for a moment of climate change, is just sort of where we are societally in terms of the discourse surrounding climate change, or really what I'm getting at is the lack thereof. Most people in this country report in surveys that they essentially never hear about climate change in their day-to-day lives. And this may sound a little bit strange to listeners of this particular program, but I think if you get out there a little bit in other parts of the country and in general, it turns out this just isn't something that people are talking about on a day-to-day basis most of the time, and we've actually seen a huge decrease in media coverage of climate change over the last few years. That's not because climate change has gone away or become less significant. In fact, quite the opposite has actually transpired in the meantime. But for a variety of societal and other converging factors, we aren't hearing about climate change as much, precisely at the moment when its impacts are beginning to become more noticeable and more profound in many places. And so what I do in my role as a very public-facing weather and climate scientist is try to connect the dots, because there really are dots to be connected between what we experience collectively day to day and the long-term changes that are unfolding all around us because of global warming and the climate changes that are resulting from that. But to do so in a way that is credible scientifically can be difficult, because this really is at the cutting edge of science. We can say things, of course, about how various kinds of extreme weather events are changing in response to global warming, and also even how individual extreme weather events might or might not be linked to long-term climate trends as well. For a while, it was said that you gotta separate your weather and your climate because they're totally different. And while they are different, I think we've maybe a little bit overemphasized that separation, because climate ultimately is, like I like to say, weather in aggregate. Climate is the envelope of weather conditions that are possible at a given place and a given time. And that warming climate is shifting that envelope. And that is the kind of thing that we do experience. We don't notice it every day, even though it's there in the background every day. But when we do notice it is when we experience wherever we happen to be, a day or a month or a year that is near the edge or outside of that envelope of weather conditions that we were accustomed to experiencing historically. And I think this November and December, the 2 months immediately prior to our conversation today, are a pretty good illustration of that in the Western U.S. in terms of the record warmth and the quite abysmal, I think it's fair to call it, start to the snow season in many locations, even at pretty high elevations so far this year.
Well, that's interesting because in the water report, we see that December precipitation in Utah was close to normal, and yet our snowpack, as you just mentioned, is quite thin, and it's not coming to us in the way of snow. And that shift in the mountain temperature being close to the warmest temperatures that we've had, is this the shape of things to come, or are we going to see these big pendulum swings coming again? Will we get more snow in the future? What does that look like? What can, you know, we even forecast at this point?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because this is a striking year for a lot of the West in the sense that in places like the Pacific Northwest, where there's actually been record-breaking flooding, if you recall back in November and December, California, where parts of Southern California have actually seen their wettest start to the winter on record, but even in parts of the Intermountain West, including parts of Utah, that have had precipitation that is near or even locally a little bit above average, and yet had at the very same time snowpacks that are extremely low or even record low. In fact, there are a number of locations in the Pacific Northwest where snowpack is at record lows despite near record high precipitation. And of course, I think you can probably already guess where I'm going with this, and you already alluded to it as well, is that the reason for this is the extraordinary, anomalous, and in many cases, record-breaking warmth that has coincided with these conditions. So unlike a number of recent drought years in the West that have been both very warm and very dry in terms of having low precipitation, this winter so far hasn't been extremely dry in terms of precipitation, in terms of the total volume of water, frozen or liquid, falling from the sky as rain or snow. That hasn't been so unusual, except in places, for example, like Arizona and Colorado, where actually there has really been low precipitation as well as warm temperatures. But everywhere else, the Pacific Northwest, California, Great Basin, and Central and Northern Rockies, including most of Utah, it's actually been reasonably damp or even wetter than average in some places, but then record warm. And until very recently, there was, in some cases, almost no snowpack at all below 6,000 or 7,000 feet in elevation. And in some cases, not even really much snow to speak of, even at the very mountaintops, the highest portions of the Rockies and the Coast Ranges and the Sierra Nevada. This is a classic global warming problem where it's not really a lack of precipitation driving the so-called snow drought this year. It really is these incredibly warm temperatures that have coincided with it in some places. And although we have gotten a bit of colder air mass and colder snow, or some snow at least, in recent days, it looks like we're once again heading for a really warm pattern coming up later in January, and we may actually lose some ground once again across a lot of the West in terms of snowpack relative to average. And I saw another striking statistic from Utah where one of the claims to fame of that powdery snow that you get in those high mountain regions, for those who are skiers or snowboarders out there, is that it's some of the fluffiest, most powdery, favorable outdoor recreation snow conditions in the country or even in the world in many years. And a striking statistic from this winter as of late December was that the snow that had fallen in Utah's highest elevations was the densest, slushiest on record. So the opposite of that typical powder. And so the snow that we do have on the ground is maybe more akin to, if anyone's familiar with the California ski scene, Sierra cement, that really heavy wet stuff that's not bad for water supply or building a base, but is not so great for skiing. And it tends to occur when temperatures are right around the freezing point, not well below freezing, but just cold enough for snow, not cold enough for those high snow ratios for that extra powder. So all of these things actually are very much something we do. We are already seeing it. We've already seen decreases in snowpack and increases in snow density over time throughout a lot of the West. But it is unfortunately a pattern we will see more often in the future. And this year is an interesting concerning for many folks, including the ski industry, signal that even in a lot of the wet years moving forward, that does not guarantee a good snowpack because if it's too warm to have snow at all, or if the snow is of really poor quality because it's really dense, that is going to have some significant implications. Will that happen every year? No. And we do see on the precipitation side, probably increasing variability. So drier dries, yes, those will probably be bad snow years when you combine low precipitation years with higher temperatures, undoubtedly. But also years that are perhaps wetter than the wettest years we're accustomed to historically. And those years may still be pretty good snow accumulation years, although we'll definitely see more accumulation higher up the mountain and it will be a little bit denser. But this increasingly wide swings between high and low precipitation years is driving part of this in parts of the West. We call this hydroclimate whiplash. But we also see that the main thing that's driving snow trends is these rising temperatures, which is meaning that there is a shorter snow accumulation season in many places, that there is, on average, not every year, but on average, less snowpack accumulating overall, and that the snow that does occur tends to be higher up the mountain, denser, wetter than historically used to be the case.
It hurts to hear about that wetter snow because we do pride ourselves here in Utah, the higher elevations, to have that powdery snow. We call it the greatest snow on earth. And we're experiencing this shift in what that looks like or feels like. And looking at the Water Supply Outlook report for Utah, as of January 1st, there were 20 Snowtell snowpack measurements. And these weather stations in Utah were at record low snow water equivalent, with eight of them experiencing their second worst conditions. So we are seeing in this data collection that even with that precipitation, because of the warmer weather, that snowpack is so low. And as you alluded to, then you've got this hydroclimate whiplash, which I want to get into a little bit more about what that means, because I think people have also heard the term yo-yo effect or that pendulum swing. So if we dive a little bit deeper into that, taking into consideration what is happening this year, how do you even begin to try to predict the weather with these extreme changes and the rapid pace by which our weather is changing?
Well, when we talk about climate change in general, the good and the bad news is we're not really making predictions about specific years. So whether or not a particular year in the future will be very wet or very dry, I really can't say, and frankly, nobody else can either. But what we can sort of divine from that by maybe squinting a little bit at the tea leaves to mix a couple of metaphors is really what that envelope of present and future weather conditions might look like relative to the past. What is the range of temperature, the range of precipitation that actually can occur? And obviously, we're shifting upward in the temperature direction. And this is where it's maybe helpful to clarify. Some folks, many folks, in fact, I've talked to about this, have assumed that this increasing variability or whiplash or these wider swings apply to both temperature and precipitation. And in fact, they don't. When it comes to temperature, we're pretty much just getting warmer. We still have, Arctic outbreaks and very cold days, but those cold days are not as cold in general as they used to be, and they're fewer and further between. Whereas the warmest days, I mean, it's not even newsworthy anymore when we get a record-breaking heat wave at any time of year because it kind of just happens all the time now, and silently in the background. We're any given year, any given location is likely to experience several episodes of record-breaking heat circa 2026, and few, if any, episodes of record-breaking cold. So we're kind of living in the future there. We're already seeing more extreme warmth and much less extreme cold. But when it comes to precipitation, it gets a little bit trickier because in a warming world, we experience what I like to call, my colleagues have begun to call the essentially the to describe the thermodynamics underpinning these increasingly wide swings between wet and dry. Consider the expanding atmospheric sponge effect. This is sort of a, I know this is a radio medium, so I'm trying to get people to visualize in their mind's eye here, but just imagine two kitchen sponges, just ordinary kitchen sponges you might use to soak up spilled water or something. on your kitchen counter, one of which is notably larger than the other. That is akin to the larger sponge, anyway, to the atmosphere in a warming climate. And actually, we can put numbers on this. That sponge expands by about 3 or 4% per degree Fahrenheit of warming. And in most of the West, we're now at least 2 and locally 4 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, depending on the season. So this is actually a noticeably larger sponge even today. So as that atmospheric sponge expands, it has the ability both to absorb more water. If you are trying to soak up some spilled water on the counter or something in this analogy, that would be the analogy of increasingly extreme precipitation. If you wring out that increasingly large saturated sponge, it's going to yield more water when saturated than the small one. But this very same physical process through the atmospheric, the expanding atmospheric sponge effect also describes why the driest dries are becoming drier, because you can imagine, unless you have spilled that water on your kitchen counter, the larger sponge doesn't actually hold more water. So if you have two sponges and they're both completely dry and one is larger than the other, that larger sponge has the capacity to absorb more water, but doesn't actually have more water in it because there's no water available. This is the state of things in the real world atmosphere when the atmosphere is not saturated, which in a place like the Intermountain West is actually most of the time. You're only saturated when you're inside a cloud and when there is some precipitation falling. But think about the number of hours, the number of days when the sun is out or when it's
Sure.
partly cloudy all throughout the year. On all of those days, the atmosphere's capacity to absorb water and therefore to evaporate water from the ground, from the soil, from bodies of water, and also essentially to induce transpiration through plants, so through the living biosphere as well, that expanded atmospheric sponge is drawing progressively more and more water out of the landscape faster and faster. So, unless you're getting a lot more precipitation on average, that net water balance in terms of how much water is left over in the soil and in bodies of water and for plants is shifting downward, even if your overall precipitation is remaining the same. So, here we actually have a mechanism to get drier dries in terms of the landscape, even if we don't actually see less precipitation overall. So ultimately, what happens is these swings between very wet and very dry conditions are widening mainly because of this expanding atmospheric sponge effect. There are some other things going on in the background, but that really is the number one thing. And unfortunately, it's something that we know with very high certainty will continue to amplify moving forward. This is not something that's speculative or really dependent on the particular climate model that you use to divine what's going to happen in the future. It's just sort of a fundamental result of basic thermodynamics. So really, if you know only two things about a warming climate in the American West, that A, temperatures are rising and that the coldest colds are less cold and less frequent, and the warmest warms are warmer and more frequent than they used to be, and that we see wider swings between wet and dry because of this expanding atmospheric sponge effect, you can understand most of the big pieces of what are going on in terms of the increase in the severity and frequency of severe droughts on the one hand,
Right.
the increase in the risk of significant flood events on the other, and changes to the snowpack, for example, where we see less snow overall, but maybe wider swings between good and bad snow years on average, snow lines that are creeping up the mountains, and also in the warm season in between, more active wildfire conditions during the dry years, largely again due to that the dry side of that expanding atmospheric sponge effect.
Well, that was such a great visual, and I think our listeners can, pardon the pun, absorb that. When you look at all of these data centers and you're taking in all this information and you're taking in all these facts from these different areas in the Mountain West, is there a hopeful output at all? Do you, as a climate communicator, try to dispel a hope into the world, and how do you do that?
Well, I think my first and foremost responsibility is to be honest and accurate as a scientist. And as a climate and weather scientist, being honest and accurate about where we are today, it has the net effect of scaring people a little bit because honestly, our trajectory is alarming. I don't think it's alarmist when the specialists are in fact alarmed to describe where we are and where we're headed. But I think sometimes people miss the fact that the reason why I do that and why we sort of collectively as climate scientists talk about these not so happy prospects is mainly to improve outcomes, not just to inform about climate change and why we need to address it so that we don't have as much of it moving forward, but also, and I think increasingly importantly, to adapt to the changes that have already occurred and that we know are inevitable moving forward to a certain degree, because it really does matter what we do in response to them. If we just pretend that the world is tomorrow is the same as the world of today, and in particular that it's the same as the world of yesterday, we're going to make some suboptimal decisions about how to move forward, about how to manage our water, how to manage the risk of wildfires, and even, you know, if you just isolate this to something like the outdoor recreation industry and the ski industries, for example, if we're not honest about where we are and where we're headed, then some of these become potentially unviable in the future. But if you make smart decisions that are forward-looking and you think about where we're headed, not just where we are today, you can preempt and proactively mitigate some of the harms and losses that might otherwise have occurred in this future if we correctly predict it and then take action to avert some of those worse outcomes. And I think that we're starting to do that when it comes to things like wildfire risk, especially in California, where people are getting rather serious about mitigation of those wildfire hazards, which do not all have to do with climate change, by the way, but actually have to do with a lot of other moving parts in the system as well. That's kind of win-win because, yes, wildfires are getting worse in a warming climate, but also they had been pretty bad even without a warming climate, and taking these actions to, you know, maintain resilience or to improve resilience to wildfire, to reduce the risk of these catastrophic wildfire losses are going to be beneficial regardless. And I think the same thing is true with things like better managing our water supply in terms of scarcity and drought risk. I know in Utah, and one of the big stories has been the Great Salt Lake. And how there's a
Right.
little bit of a relief this year, but the long-term picture, you know, is still concerning. But that's also an active management problem. That's not just a question of what is the climate doing to us, sort of exogenously and out of the control of the folks in Utah, but it's also a question of how is the water in that lake being managed in terms of how we're using it, or the water that might otherwise be flowing into the lake being managed. And those are things we do get to control, that we do get to make decisions about, and that we can change are the ways that we've managed historically. The same thing is true of flood risk. So I think that the reason why I talk about these kinds of things, which can sound big and bad and doomy and gloomy and scary to some folks, is mainly to say that if we're honest about where we are and where we're headed, we can make much better decisions about what we're going to do next and improve the future.
Right.
So I think there's still water out there, and it's, you know, if we learn to manage it differently, then we're going to have a much better future than if we just sort of make these assumptions predicated on the past that what has worked historically will continue to work moving forward. So a big part of my message and my role is to kind of be explicit about that and tell us, you know, where we are and where we're headed so we can make those better decisions.
There is so many layers to this, and I appreciate you coming on This Green Earth. Dr. Daniel Swain, you are going to be in conversation with the community, and people can listen to a webinar that's put on by Mountain Towns 2030 coming up this Wednesday, January 14th at 10 a.m. And you can go to mt2030.org to learn more about that. So we appreciate you so much for coming on the show. Thank you, Dr. Swain.
Thanks again for having me.